The following program is brought to you by Audio Journal, a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind, with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, its staff, or volunteers. Welcome all to Audio Journal's Extraordinary Tales, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to stories that are off the beaten path, inspiring awe, wonder, and at times, terror and fright that will send shivers down your spine. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm George Bloomquist, and for the next hour, I'll be regaling you with a number of tales that are truly off the beaten path, beginning with one of Edgar Allan Poe's most chilling stories, The Telltale Heart. Before I begin, though, here's a brief thumbnail sketch about the author. Born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1809, Edgar Allan Poe was the second child of actors David and Elizabeth Poe. His father abandoned the family in 1810, and when Elizabeth died the following year, Poe was taken in by John and Frances Allen of Richmond, Virginia, and he lived with them well into his adulthood. During his tumultuous lifetime, Poe became a writer, poet, editor, and literary critic who became best known for his poetry and short stories, particularly those involving mystery and the macabre, of which The Telltale Heart is a prime example. In addition, Poe is considered by many as the inventor of the detective fiction genre, after which Sir Arthur Conan Doyle modeled his Sherlock Holmes. Sadly, on October 3, 1849, Poe was found semi-conscious in a Baltimore alleyway under mysterious circumstances. He died 4 days later at the Washington Medical Hospital, and his cause of death is unknown to this very day. And so, without further ado, here's The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe.
Who?
Nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken, and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object, there was none. Passion, there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. One of his eyes resembled that of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man, and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern all closed, closed, so that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my whole head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me a whole hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well within the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked, and I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into his chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a haughty tone, and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moved more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers and my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even so to dream my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in the bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still, and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief, oh no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it had welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I know that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "Ah, 'tis nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim, and it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little, crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a single dim ray, like the thread of a spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was wide open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray, as if by instinct, precisely upon that damaged spot. And now, have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the senses? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous, and so I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet, for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. Ha ha ha! When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what did I have now to fear? There entered three men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard, they said, by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled, for what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted familiar things. But ere long I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat, and still they chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definitiveness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice. Yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observation of the men. But the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no, no! They heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This, I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder! 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 Villains! I shrieked. Dissemble no more! I admit the deed! Tear up the planks! Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart! And so concludes The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. Our next extraordinary tale is titled The Phantom Woman by author unknown, and which is found in the superb anthology Ghosts, A Treasury of Chilling Tales, Old and New, selected and edited by Marvin Kaye, Longmeadow Press, 1981. In his introduction to the story, Kaye writes the following. One of the most dangerous kinds of ghost is the handsome or beautiful spirit who lures a member of the opposite sex to his or her destruction. One might argue whether such creatures really are incubi or succubi, or just ordinary ghosts with a grudge against the opposite sex. Whatever their origin, they are especially insidious. But then those who seek comeliness above all other attributes ought to be wary of the results, no matter what plane the object of their affection dwells on. Here, then, is The Phantom Woman by Anonymous. He took an all-possessing, burning fancy to her from the first. She was neither young nor pretty, so far as he could see, but she was wrapped round with mystery. That was the key of it all. She was noticeable in spite of herself. Her face at the window, sunset after sunset, her eyes gazing out mournfully through the dusty panes, hypnotized the lawyer. He saw her through the twilight night after night, and he grew at length to wait through the days in a feverish waiting for dusk and that one look at an unknown woman. She was always at the same window on the ground floor, sitting, doing nothing. She looked beyond, so the infatuated solicitor fancied, at him. Once he even thought he detected the ghost of a friendly smile on her lips. Their eyes always met with a mute desire to make acquaintance. This romance went on for a couple of months. Gilbert Dent assured himself that nothing in this life could possibly remain stationary, and he cudgeled his brain for a respectable manner of introducing himself to his idol. He had hardly arrived at this point when he received a shock. There came an evening when she was not at the window. Next morning, he walked down Wood Lane on his way to the office. He always went by train, but he felt a strong disinclination to go through another day without a sight of her. His heart began to beat like a schoolgirl's as he drew near the house. If she should be at the window. He was almost disposed to take his courage in his hand and call on her, and yes, even tell her in a quick burst that she had mysteriously become all the world to him. He could see nothing ridiculous in this course, and the possibility of her being married or having family ties of any sort had simply never occurred to him. However, she was not at the window. What was more, there was a sinister silence, a sort of breathlessness about the place. It was a very hot morning in late August. He looked a long time, but no face came, and no movement stirred the house. He went his way, walking like a man who had been heavily knocked on the brow, and ceased stir still. That afternoon he left the office early, and in less than an hour stood at the gate again. The window was blank. He pushed the gate back, it hung on one hinge, and he walked up the drive to the door. There were five steps leading up to it. At the foot, he wheeled aside sharply to the window. He had a sick dread of looking through the small panes. Why, he could not have told. When at last he found courage to look, he saw that there was a small round table set just under the window, a work table to all appearance, one of those things with lots of little compartments all around and a lid in the middle, which shut over a well-like cavity for the holding pieces of needlework. He remembered that his mother had one 30 years before. Round the edge of the table was gripped a small, delicate hand. Gilbert Dent's eyes ran from this bloodless hand and slim wrist to a shoulder under a coarse, stiff bodice, to a rather wasted throat, which was bare and flung back. So this was the end, before the beginning. He saw her. She was dead, twisted on the floor with a ghastly face turned up toward the ceiling, and stiff fingers caught in desperation round the work-table. He stumbled away along the path and into the lane. For a long time he could not realize the horror of this thing. The influence of the decayed house hung over him. Nothing seemed real. It was quite dark when he moved away from the gate and went in the direction to the nearest police station. That she was dead, this woman whose very name he did not know, although she influenced him so powerfully, he was certain. One look at the face would have told anyone that. That she was murdered was more than suspected. He had seen no blood about, but there had been no mark on the long, bare throat, and yet the word rushed in his ears, murder. Later on, he went back with a police officer. They broke into the house and entered the room. It was in utter darkness, of course, by now. Dent, his fingers trembling, struck a match. It flared round the walls and lighted them for a moment before he let it fall to the dusty floor. The policeman began to light his lantern and turned it stolidly on the window. He had no reason for delay. He was eager to get to the bottom of the business. His professional zeal was whetted. This promised to be a mystery with a spice in it. He turned the light full on the window. He gave a strange choked cry, half of rage, half of apprehension. Then he went up to Gilbert Dent, who stood in the middle of the room with his hands before his eyes, and took his shoulder and shook it none too gently. "There ain't nobody here," he said. Dent looked wildly at the window. The recess was empty, except for the work table. The woman was gone. They searched the house. They minutely inspected the garden. Everything was normal. Everything told the same mournful tale of desertion, of death, of long empty years. But they found no woman, nor trace of one. "This house," said the policeman, looking suspiciously at the lawyer's face, "has been empty for longer than I can remember. Nobody's ever lived in it. They do say something about foul play a good many years ago, but I don't know about that. All I do know is that the landlord can't get it off his hands. It was doubtful, however, if Gilbert Dent heard one word of what the man was saying. He was too stunned to do anything but creep home, when he was allowed to go, and he let himself stealthily into his own house with a latchkey. He was afraid even of himself. He did not go to bed that night. As for the mystery of the woman, well, that matter was allowed to drop. It ended officially. There was a shrug and a grin at the police station. The impression there was that the lawyer had been drinking, and that the dead woman in the empty room was a gruesome freak of his tipsy brain. A week or so later, Dent called on his brother, Ned, the one near relation he had. Ned was a doctor. Perhaps he was a shade more matter-of-fact than Gilbert. At all events, when the latter told his story of the house and the woman, he attributed the affair solely to liver. "You're overworked," the elder brother looked at his brother's yellow face. "An experience of this nature is by no means uncommon. Haven't you ever heard of people having their pet spooks?" "But this was a real woman," he declared. I was in love with her. I had made up my mind to marry her, if I could." Ned gave him a keen, swift glance. "We'll go to Brighton tomorrow," he said, with a quiet decision. "As for your work, everything must be put aside. You've run completely down. You ought to have been taken in hand before." They went to Brighton, and it really seemed as if Ned was right, and that the woman at the window had been merely a nervous creation. It seemed so, that is, for nearly 3 weeks, and then the climax came. It was in the twilight, she had always been part of it, that Gilbert Dent saw her again, the woman that he had found lying dead. They were walking, the two brothers, along the cliffs. The wind was blowing in their faces, the sea was booming beneath the cliff. Ned had just said that it was about time they turned back to the hotel and have some dinner, when Gilbert, with a cry, leapt forward to the very edge of the flat grass path on which they were strolling. The movement was so sudden that his brother barely caught him in time. They struggled and swayed on the very edge of the cliff for a second, and then Gilbert, possessed by some sudden frenzy, seemed resolved to go over. But the other at last dragged him backward, and they rolled together on the close thick turf. At this point Gilbert opened his eyes and tried to get on his feet. "Better?" asked his brother cheerfully, holding out a helping hand. "Strange. The sea has that effect on some people. Didn't think you were one of them." "What effect?" "Vertigo, my dear fellow." "Ned," said the other solemnly, "I saw her. It's not worth your while to try to account for anything. I have been inclined to think that you were right, that she, the woman at the window, was a fancy, that I had fallen in love with a creation of my own brain. But I saw her again tonight. You must have seen her yourself. She was within a couple of feet of you. Why did you not try and save her? It was nothing short of murder to let her go over like that. I did my best." "You certainly did, to kill both of us," said Ned grimly. Gilbert gave him a wild look. After lunch, Ned persuaded him to rest, watched him fall asleep, and then went out. In the porch of the hotel, he was met by a waiter on his return, who had told him that Gilbert had left about a quarter of an hour after he had gone out himself. Directly he heard this, he feared the worst, having, as is usual in such cases, a very hazy idea of what the worst might be. Of course, he must follow without a moment's delay, but a reference to the timetable told him that there was not another train for an hour, and that was slow. It was already getting dusk when he arrived there. He felt certain that Gilbert would go there. He got to the end of the lane and walked up it slowly, examining every house. There would be no difficulty in recognizing the one he wanted. Gilbert had described it in detail more than once. He stood outside the loosely hanging gate at last and stared through the darkness at the shabby stucco front and rank garden. He went down a flight of steps to the back door, and, finding it unfastened, stepped into a stone passage. It was one of the problems of the place that he should have avoided, the main entrance door with a half-admitted dread, and that, only half-admitting still, he was afraid to mount the long flight of stone stairs leading from the servants' quarters. However, he pulled himself together and went up to the room. It was quite dark inside. He heard something scuttle across the floor. He felt the grit and dust of years under his feet. He struck a match, just as Gilbert had done, and looked first at the recess in which the window was built. The match flared around the room for a moment and gave him a flash picture of his surroundings. He saw the stripes of gaudy paper moving almost imperceptibly, like tentacles of some sea monster, from the wall. He saw a creature, it looked like a rat, scurry across the floor from the window to the great mantelpiece of hard white marble. If he had seen nothing more than this. He saw in detail all that the first match had flashed at him. He saw his brother lying on the floor. A ghastly coincidence, his hand was caught round the edge of the work-table as hers had been. The other hand was clenched across his breast. There was a look of great agony on his face. A dead face, of course. This was the end of the affair. He was lying dead by the window where the woman had sat every night at dusk and smiled at him. The second match went out. The brother of the dead man struck a third. He looked again and closely. Then he staggered to his feet and gave a cry. It rang through the empty rooms and echoed without wearying down the long stone passages in the basement. Gilbert's head was thrown back. His chin peaked at the ceiling. On his throat were livid marks. The doctor saw them distinctly. He saw the grip of small fingers, the distinct impression of a woman's little hand. The curious thing about the whole story, the most curious thing, perhaps, is that no other eye ever saw those murderous marks. So there was no scandal, no chase after the murderer, no undiscovered crime. They faded. When the doctor saw his brother again in the full light and in the presence of others, his throat was clear, and the post-mortem proved that death was due to natural causes. And so the matter stands, and will. But where the house and its overgrown garden once stood runs a new road with neat red and white villas. Whatever secret it knew, if any, it kept discreetly. Ned Dent is morbid enough to go down the smart new road in the twilight sometimes and wonder. The End. We conclude today's program with excerpts from the book Strange New England, edited by Thomas DiAgostino and Arlene Nicholson, History Press, 2021. The book recalls the many strange characters, stories, and oddities found in New England folklore and legend throughout the centuries. And today, I'll be reading excerpts from Chapter 2, titled Curses, beginning with the legend of Aunt Lonnie Davis. It reads, Foster, Rhode Island, seems to command a great deal of attention when it comes to ghosts, witches, and vampires. Old maps of the town contain strange location monikers named after the peculiar folk who graced those locales. Names such as Witch Hill, Witch Rock, and Ghost Lot are but a few of the area's nicknames named after its residents and legends. One of Foster's more prominent was a woman named Mary Aunt Lonnie Davis. Aunt Lonnie lived on Tucker Hollow Road on the Scituate Foster border. She was a recluse, thought by many, to be in league with the evil one. Lonnie would push her cart down Route 6 to the village of Hopkin Mills, where she would procure her necessities before pushing the full cart back up the steep hill toward home. Occasionally, an unwary youth would offer assistance, only to be spurned with an evil eye. Lonnie seemed to have an aversion with the townfolk to the point where she not only avoided contact with them, but demanded that upon her death her home would be demolished and her property forever remain unimproved. It was a strange request with an even stranger consequence. She swore that if so much of two boards remained nailed together, she would haunt the area until her wish was granted in full. When Aunt Lonnie died, the townspeople failed to adhere to her demands and soon paid the price for their action. Whenever someone passed by the abandoned property, unearthly screams would emanate from the home, and a cold breath would send a chill down their backs. If anyone dared venture into the cursed land, a voice would whisper in their ear, accompanied by a bone-chilling wind. If this was not enough to convince the trespasser to vacate her property, a vigorous push by unseen hands sent the intruder fleeing in fear. It came to pass that the only way the neighbors could be rid of Aunt Lonnie was to fulfill her last wish. The home was torn down, and no two boards remained nailed together. They finally were rid of the curse, or so they thought. The land where Lonnie Davis once lived is now called the Ghost Lot, and continues to be haunted centuries later. A 1947 map exhibits the location of the plot that is aptly named. There is a foundation where Aunt Lonnie's home once stood, and that parcel of land remains untouched. Mary Davis and her husband, Joseph, are buried in the Tucker Hollow Cemetery, very close to the Ghost Lot. Perhaps Aunt Lonnie was a nickname given to Mary. Lonnie could have been her middle name. Her birth date is unknown, but her death date, 1799, is clearly marked on the crude stone marker that sits among the brush and growth in the old burying yard. Up next, The Curse of Micah Rood's Apples. This little tale of New England's myths and mysteries is a perennial favorite of the region. It is also true. Sit back and raise the flame on your lantern so you can see the shadows dancing on the walls as you hear about Franklin, Connecticut's cursed apples. Now, many do not believe in curses, as such vexes were tales designed to keep children in their beds long after the lights were drawn. In Franklin, many of the old-timers not only believe in curses, but some of them have actually ingested the remnants of a particular act of vengeance wrought upon a man over three centuries ago. There is a place where an apple tree once bore fruit, with what appeared to be a single drop of blood in the center. Do not look for the tree now, though. It is long gone, but the legend and accounts that follow will live as an eternal reminder of the price of greed and murder. Micah Rood, born in 1653, was a farmer in what was once called 9 Mile Square, or Norwich West Farms, presently Franklin, Connecticut. Rood married Sarah Danes on January 15, 1693, and had three children, Mary, Micah, and Joseph. His farm rambled along the Peck Hollow section of the settlement. The youngest son of Thomas Rood, Micah, came to settle there in 1699. By some accounts, Rood was known to be friendly and outgoing, always taking time to help anyone in need. But others say he was a mean and nasty brute. One thing was sure. Rood's apple orchard was the finest and best tended in the region. One December evening, a peddler named Horgan passed along the edge of Rood's farm. Many of the local housewives and working gentry eagerly awaited his semi-annual visits to see what wares he had in his bag for sale to the good people of the town. In the 17th, 18th, and even the 19th centuries, peddlers were the common shopping medium. These roving stores wandered the countryside, selling everything from pots and pans to trinkets and jewelry. Horgan seemed to have a fine array of items that would make almost any man want to rifle his sack. By all known accounts, the itinerant peddler sold much of his wares that day, and now possessed a hefty pouch of money collected from his dealings. The next versions are indeed a matter of conjecture as to what transpired next. Some say that the peddler on a roll decided to try his luck at Rude's home, while others claim he was coerced into the house by Rude for reasons no good. Either way, the peddler was found the next day under one of Rude's apple trees with his head split open, his sack empty, and his money pouch gone. All fingers pointed toward Rude, but he vehemently denied any wrongdoing. In fact, he brought to the attention of the authorities that Horgan had spoken of two men who had attempted to waylay the traveling salesman at the Blue Horse Tavern the day before. Rude even let the authorities search his home, yet they found no sign of any violence or any of the peddler's property. Morgan was buried in the potter's field. Although the villagers were convinced Rude had something to do with his demise, they had no evidence, and so the matter was soon put aside. Spring wore on, and Rude's orchard once again began to prosper. No one could prove that Rude may have killed the peddler, but nature was about to throw a strange light on the suspicion of the townfolk. When the flowers bloomed, the apple trees blossomed with their usual sweet-smelling white flowers, except for one tree. The tree where the peddler was found bore red flowers. Though odd, no one gave it much thought until August brought the fruits of labor forth. The townsfolks were quite astonished when they found the apples that came from that particular tree in Rude's orchard had a curious nature to them. When broken open, there was a red globule in the center that resembled a drop of blood. Every apple on the tree had within the blood stain of the man who was murdered so hideously. The people began to call them mites, for although they concealed the strange crimson blot within, they were unusually delicious. As for Rude, he began a slow and cryptic deterioration of both physical and mental health. The once vivacious soul was now a frail recluse. Always fearful and melancholy, he refused to eat and began wasting away. Neighbors reported hearing his screams in the night, and when they crept to his window, he was seen pacing to and fro in the darkest hours in front of a solitary candle. Within a short time, his farm withered along with his will to live. Every tree soon gave up the ghost but one. Year after year, that cursed tree bore the silent damnation of the apples with the bloody heart. Many came to believe that the peddler's spirit had come to roost on the branches of the tree, thus tainting the fruit it bore. One season, a daring youth stole into Rude's orchard and began to loot the infamous tree of its harvest. Rude offered him all of the tree's fruit, screeching, "Take the whole lot, boy! I don't want the accursed things." Rude's condition worsened. His fences fell into ruin. His home became a neglected relic, and his barn decayed and swayed with the valley breezes that swept through the countryside. It is said he was terrified to work in the fields, for the wraith of the peddler was always waiting there to torture him for his deed. In 1717, he was given the task of maintaining the meeting house, and in return, the congregation compensated him with a peck of corn from each family. Having long given up on living, his tortuous existence continued, yet there bore no confession on his lips as to what happened to the peddler, Horgan, so many years ago. The bloody apples still poured from the tree that sat on the once fertile land, now overgrown with brush and bramble. In 1727, it came to pass that Rude needed constant attention, as he had become too feeble to care for himself. An historic record entered into the Church Society states as follows. July 5, 1727. The inhabitants do now, by their vote, agree to allow each man that watches with Micah Rude 2 shillings per night. Also, to those who attend to said Rude by day, 3 shillings per day. Micah Rude finally passed away in December 1728. It is written that he died in a chair overlooking the tree that bore the bloody fruit of vengeance. On December 17, 1728, the society paid 4 shillings to Jacob Hyde for digging Root's grave. As for his wife, she died on May 10, 1749, at the age of 94. His 3 children seem to have faded into history. However, the tree lasted as a living monument to the unsolved crime for 2 more centuries, still bearing forth its peculiar harvest until the hurricane of 1938 finally blew the relic down. Several attempts were made to cultivate the mics by grafting the branches and roots with other strains. Still, there is no record of whether anyone ever successfully reproduced the apples that silently and eternally condemned Micah Rood for his evil deed. Some say that a few trees were grafted successfully and bear traces of the bloody apple. Take a ride into Franklin and visit some of the orchards around the harvest time. Maybe, just maybe, you will find an apple with a blood-red heart. If so, then it is clear that the curse of Micah Rood is still alive in those delicious apples that gave so many taste buds pleasure and one man eternal pain. The Hayden Family Curse. Do you believe in curses? Many scoff at such rants brought forth from the tongues of those who feel wronged for one reason or another. In the case of the Hayden family of Albany, Vermont, most had no chance to render their opinion until it was too late. In 1798, William Hayden married Silence Dale. They moved from their Braintree, Massachusetts residence to the region of Craftsbury, Vermont, thanks to the financial aid of Silence's wealthy mother, Mercy Dale. Mercy was, at the time, a widow and thought it wise to move in with the young couple. William had grand plans for their future and began borrowing money from the aging old woman with the promise of paying her back every penny. This scenario became a regular incident in which Mercy complied for some time, yet had not received a single shilling of recompense. With money borrowed from Mercy, William purchased a large tract of land that would later become the town of Albany. With this, William began to work on business ventures, build a mansion, and live the life of a noble, all on his mother-in-law's savings. Every time Mercy demanded her money from William, he would come up with some excuse to defer the payment. The day came when she refused any more advances on his loans and demanded what was owed to her. After all, he had a grand mansion, lots of land, and several other holdings. This was when things began to go wrong for Mercy. She suddenly took ill. As her condition worsened, she feared her son-in-law was poisoning her, but her daughter refused to believe William could be so nefarious. Desperate and ailing, Mercy arranged to room with her friend Sally Rogers, who lived nearby. She knew her son-in-law was trying to be rid of her, so he would not have to pony up the vast amount of money he owed her. As she left the splendid mansion she had so unwillingly funded, she placed a curse on William, stating, "The Hayden family shall perish in the 3rd generation, and the last to die shall do so in great poverty." William laughed off the curse made by the old woman as the ranting of a delirious hag. Mercy died a short time later and was buried in the Rogers family plot. Perhaps she intended the curse to take effect long after her daughter was gone to relieve her of such grief in her lifetime. Soon after Mercy's passing, William's luck began to change. Some of his more dubious dealings started to catch up with him, and he found himself fleeing Albany, eventually settling in Farnsworth, New York, where he died in 1846, an impoverished, broken man. Out of the 9 children he had fathered, only 2, one son and one daughter, reached adulthood. His daughter, Arethusa, died childless at the age of 64. His son, William Jr., grew to manhood and married. His mother, Silence Dale Hayden, still living in Albany, died in 1872 at 94. This was the end of the first generations of the Hayden family curse. William Jr. married and started a family of his own, but was bewildered as his wife, Azaba, gave birth to all daughters. Finally, the fifth child, William Henry, was born, and he was sure that the now decades-old curse was nothing more than a bunch of bunk perpetrated by unfortunate coincidence. William Henry, known as Henry, became successful in business, building a great house with a suspended ballroom on the top floor to entertain the socialites of the day. Will and Azubah's five children, Henry, Julia, Mary, Azubah, and Alvina, marked the third generation of William Sr. Hayden's family, the target of Mercy's curse. That was when the curse took its final hold on the Haydens. All of Will and Azubah's children either died young or failed to produce male heirs. The only son, Henry, began to exhibit signs of insanity, yet managed to marry, having three girls and one son. All of them died without producing another generation of Haydens, his son dying in 1871 at the tender age of five. William Jr. grew old and feeble, watching the family fortune erode under the unstable Henry's control, the last male heir of the family name. Henry died in 1910 of a cerebral hemorrhage. The last person of the family lineage alive was his daughter, Armenia Mamie Hayden. On February 20, 1927, she died poverty-stricken, unmarried and alone, thus ending the Hayden name and fulfilling the family curse. The old mansion still exists and is now a private residence. There are stories and accounts for the possibility of it being haunted, but they may be just stories to accompany the impetus of the curse. Subsequent owners have attested that there is nothing paranormal within the mansion, which may strengthen the curse's power that wiped out the Hayden family forever, including their ghosts. We conclude with Rachel's curse. In Plymouth, Massachusetts, there once lived an old woman the locals called Aunt Rachel. She carried a modest living, telling fortunes to the locals, but it was mostly sailors who called upon her talents of predicting the weather and their future. One day, a few sailors called upon her for her talents, and she immediately recognized one as a fellow villager. The others she knew to be of shady character, and Rachel chided the local for keeping society with the rogues he was with. One of the other men interrupted her lecture by stating, "None of your slack, old woman, or I'll put a stopper on your gab." It was then that Rachel began calling them mooncussers, those who lure ships with false beacons onto rocks or shore for plunder. She looked the man straight in the eye and cursed, "He who rides the pale horse be your guide, and you be the number who follow him." That night, Rachel's house mysteriously burned to the ground, almost taking her with it. A few days later, the brig, with the men who had visited her previously, was ready to set sail, and Rachel joined the townfolk to see it off. The owner of the brig offered his deepest sympathies on the loss of her home, but she retorted by stating, "I need it no longer anyway, for the narrow house will soon be my home, and you wretches cannot burn that. But you, who will console you for the loss of your brig? She now carries a curse and will not sail long." The owner scoffed at the old woman's words, for he had no doubt his ship was seaworthy and his crew among the most experienced to sail those waters. This he assured Rachel as the brig navigated past the hidden shoals and bars that had claimed so many other vessels. All the while, the old woman mumbled enchanted curses in the direction of the brig, and then, in a blinding moment, she thrust her bony arm into the air and let out a scream like a banshee. The crowd focused their attention on her, but was quickly drawn away by a cry from another. The brig had come to a sudden stop and shuddered before breaking up. It listed and sank until only the tops of the masts were visible above the water. Rescue crews frantically rowed out to the sunken ship, picking up the crew as they swam for their lives. All were brought to shore and accounted for, except for one, the man who dared insult Rachel and burn her home. During the melee, no one noticed that Rachel had died just after the ship had hit the rock, previously unknown to the area's navigators. Rachel was buried on the site where her house once stood, and the rock that sent the brig to its doom was forever known as Rachel's Curse. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our program today as much as I've had in reading it to you. And I'm here to remind you that you've been listening to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Extraordinary Tales, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117, or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org, or by mailing us at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm George Blomquist, thanking you for listening. And now, stay tuned for other local programming brought to you by Audio Journal. Listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.
Hello, sports fans. Did you know that Audio Journal has a weekly one-hour program that features news and inspiring stories about disabled and visually impaired folks participating in sports at the local, national, and international level? That's AJ Sports Page. Tune in on Fridays from 5 to 6 p.m. That's AJ Sports Page, airing every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Archived episodes are available on demand on our website, www.audiojournal.org. That's AJ Sports Page, a production of Audio Journal. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.